Hey, Rob.
How are you doing, Carl?
Good. My name is Carl Zimmer, and I'm a science writer. And with me here is Rob Carlson. Rob, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Rob Carlson. I'm a principal at an engineering and design firm, consulting firm in Seattle called Biodesic.
Yeah, so I've been following your work, Rob, for quite a while because one thing that I'm really interested in is the rise of a new kind of biotechnology, a new way of using biology to create kinds of new technology, and sometimes it's called synthetic biology. And you have really been involved deeply in trying to get a sense of where we are now and where we're going to be going in terms of our ability to make new synthetic DNA and program cells and do all sorts of potentially really amazing, slightly scary things like new energy sources and new kinds of medicines, and if things don't go well, perhaps new kinds of bioterrorism. But so I was hoping that we could talk a bit about where you see this whole incredible field of essentially recreating life and where we're going to go with it. I guess if people have heard of you, they may have heard of you in terms of something that's called the Carlson Curve. I think it's very cool that you have a curve named after you. Why don't you just explain to everybody what the Carlson Curve is in terms of the progress that's happening in biotechnology these days?
Well, this was my attempt, starting in about 2000, to figure out how fast we were going. I had written an essay trying to get my head around where I thought the future of biological engineering, or now we call it synthetic biology, or perhaps that's some subset of biological engineering. This is something we can get into as the conversation goes on. Anyway, I'd written this essay trying to sort out where I thought things were going, and it occurred to me it might be useful to try to measure quantitatively how fast the technology was changing. And we have other examples of that in other fields, Moore's Law being the most obvious, that is the number of transistors per chip. So I set out to try to figure out what to measure.
Let me just interrupt about Moore's Law, just so you can remind me. So Moore's Law says that... What does Moore's Law basically say about the increase in processing power in computers?
So Moore's Law says that very roughly the number of transistors per chip doubles every 18 months. The other way to look at that, every 18 months. The other way to look at that is that the costs are falling exponentially. So the same computing power is available in 2 years at half the cost or something like that.
Right, right.
So having that in the back of my head, I was pondering what I might be able to measure to similarly track progress in biology. And sitting back thinking about just raw numbers, Moore's Law isn't that interesting by itself unless you think of it as a way that technology enables something new for humans. And what it really tells you about supposedly is productivity. That is, how much stuff can you do with a new chip when it shows up on your desktop? So, similarly, what could we measure in biology that has to do with productivity in the lab? You could conjure up any number of different metrics, I suppose. Two that I was interested in particularly at the time, because I was interested in writing and reading DNA as ways to build new circuits and build new organisms, is simply the productivity and the costs of reading and writing DNA, so DNA sequencing and DNA synthesis. And you can go out and find commercial instruments that do both of those things. So then the question is, if you had a room full of those instruments, how much DNA could you read or write in a day? And by tracking that over time, you come up with some exponential curves that, to my surprise, actually track Moore's Law pretty well. I think that's just a coincidence. And for publicity's sake, I just got lucky, because you can put them on the same plot, and they're three straight lines that go right next to each other.
Hmm. Our ability to sequence or to synthesize DNA is accelerating kind of in the same way that processors have been, according to Moore's Law? Is that basically where we're at now?
Well, it's the same rough rate. I don't know that it necessarily has anything to do with Moore's Law, if that's what you're asking. It's just that the doubling time in our productivity, or the halving time, I guess you could say, in the cost, is between 18 months and 2 years for both of those technologies, just as it is for Moore's Law. There are some people who read something very deep about technology into those numbers. I don't know that I do. That's just what the data says.
It is pretty amazing to read about the early days in gene sequencing. And by early, I mean, I guess, you know, the early 1990s, where, you know, people would be spending their whole career just trying to get the sequence of one gene, just one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now the amount of DNA that's being published, you know, that they're just dumping into these databases is just on this astronomical scale. That side of things, it's been incredible. But I guess the reverse is true, too, that it took a lot of work to piece together the building blocks of DNA before, but now, you know, now people are able to essentially make genes to order, right?
That's right. So, there are two pieces. There's reading DNA and writing DNA. And I wouldn't want to confuse all the labor that goes, or obscure somehow all the labor that goes into either of those activities. It still takes a lot of mental effort to make sense of the sequence that comes out of a machine. It's not just that you throw DNA at an instrument and you get back a bunch of magical information that tells you how an organism works. There's a huge amount of knowledge and effort and person years that go into that. Similarly, just making DNA as a chemical doesn't actually result in functional genes immediately. There's some, not magic, but art still that goes into it. And the nice thing about that kind of art, at least as far as an engineering process goes, is that you can teach that kind of art to robots for both sequencing and synthesis, which means that productivity, the ability to read and write DNA, is improving with our ability to automate just about everything. So laboratory robotics builds on other kinds of robotics, so that in biology labs and startup companies that have access to these technologies, they're getting substantial improvements on a, you know, daily or weekly basis, monthly anyway, in terms of what they can get delivered to their doorstep just by sending out either physical DNA for sequencing or a sequence of DNA via email and getting physical DNA back via FedEx.
Your DNA has arrived. Yeah.
I got some just yesterday, as a matter of fact.
Oh, you got some DNA in the mail?
That's right.
What do they come in? Do they come in like little flasks, or are they
just a little centrifuge tube? You know, it's about an inch long. It doesn't look very special. Depends on how it arrives. It might arrive in solution. It might arrive already inside an organism. In either case, you could have a little bit of fluid at the bottom of the tube, or it could just be dried. It would look like just schmutz, basically some dirt in the bottom of the tube, until you pull it back out and try to do something interesting with it.
I mean, we'll get back to this more later, but I'm curious. Does DNA just come in the mail just like anything else? I mean, you know, does your FedEx guy know that he's delivering to you synthetic genes, or is there some special procedure that you got to do to get the stuff?
Nothing special at the moment. You just email out your sequence to the company you want to make that DNA, and they ship it back to you. It could be long, could be short, and the length determines how much it costs, but other than that, there's no barrier to access. You need an internet connection and a credit card. That's it.
That's it. Wow. So you got this book that you've just finished called Biology is Technology, that's going to be coming out in the fall from Harvard University Press. And I'm really looking forward to seeing it because I've really been interested in some of your previous writings about kind of how we got here in terms of biology and then where biology as technology is going. I mean, you've really, I guess, have really seen the rise of what we now call synthetic biology. I mean, you I get the feeling that you were kind of there at the birth of it, as it were. You know, people are just starting to become aware of synthetic biology, at least people who read, you know, science magazines. But when did it occur to you that something was really happening, that there might be something that deserved a new name of its own?
Back in about 1999 or 2000 or so, when I was writing this first essay, I was struggling to come up with a phrase that I thought encapsulated how the world was changing. And it was pretty clear to me then, and it's even clearer to me now, that the change we're seeing has to do with applying engineering techniques that exist in all other parts of the economy to biology, to genetic circuits. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy, doesn't mean it's going to happen overnight, but it is happening. And that's true at scales everywhere from professors at Ivy League institutions or community colleges to undergraduates at colleges all over the world, to startups, to established companies. They're all using new approaches to engineer biology, but those approaches look very familiar if you're used to building a computer or a car or an airplane. I could see the hint of that in 2000. It was pretty clear that was going to happen, and it was built around the idea that you could just order out DNA that you had designed. There's a lot of there's a lot of other infrastructure that goes along with building cars and computers and airplanes that doesn't exist yet in biology, like design tools, models, predictive models. The famous example in aviation is the 777, the first airplane from Boeing that was designed entirely on a computer. They never tested any of those parts. They put the airplane together, and they flew the first one. It is remarkable to me to this day that that test pilot had enough confidence to hop in the first airplane and fly it off the ground, but that's what he did, just a few miles from here, as a matter of fact. So that's in my head, and looking at DNA synthesis, that's kind of in my head too, and thinking about how you measure and model biological systems, that was all in my head, trying to sort out where that would lead us. And the first time, the first effort at giving this a name came out of conversations I was having with Drew Endy, who's now at Stanford. We were both at a place called the Molecular Sciences Institute in Berkeley. And the first go-round at a name was intentional biology. That is, there would be intentional engineering of biological systems. So, unfortunately, I learned a bit of a branding lesson there, because, of course, when biologists hear that, they feel as if we're labeling everything that's come before as unintentional biology. That resulted in some rotten tomatoes being thrown at us, me in particular, if you like. So we rapidly started looking around for a new name. The name was already in existence, it's just that we hadn't tuned into it at the time. We were, Drew and I were both at a cocktail party thrown by Nature magazine in San Francisco about that time, 2000-2001. Bumped into another scientist who said, oh, it just looks like synthetic chemistry. Really what we're going to see is synthetic biology. It's going to work exactly the same way. And so that, of course, draws on a long history in science, going back to Friedrich Wöhler and his students and the slow rise of synthetic organic chemistry.
So that was in the 1800s when Wöhler, he synthesized, what was it, urea or uric acid? I forget, something like that?
Urea.
One of these compounds that, you know, that animals and people make, and he just showed you could make it in the lab?
That's right. So there was an argument at the time about whether organic chemicals could be synthesized from scratch. The vital force was thought by many to animate, animals, plants, anything that was living, and that was a barrier that you couldn't cross by synthesis. And even it turns out the story about Wohler is a little more complicated than people usually think about. He synthesized urea using wastes from a tannery plant, so wastes that could be thought of as derived from biological systems, from living systems. So there was still some argument that he hadn't really shown that the vital force had nothing to do with organic chemistry.
Right.
But that barrier fell too soon with one of his students, who did in fact synthesize other organic compounds, totally from scratch, totally from inorganic precursors.
And challenging vitalism, the idea that there was a vital force that was in all living things and was totally different from inorganic life. I mean, inorganic matter.
That's right.
Yeah.
So bringing that forward to today, the thought is that by building up biological systems, genetic systems from pieces, will cross a similar threshold of knowledge that allows us to build more complicated systems that actually work the way that we intend.
Right.
And that's...
Yeah, because in the 1970s, I mean, it was pretty... With genetic engineering, it was pretty rudimentary in the sense that people would... You know, they might identify a gene for, like, human insulin and stick it in E. coli, for example, and then E. coli would make human insulin, and that was about as far as it went. I mean, there was some fine-tuning, but I guess that's not... You would not consider that quite the sort of... not quite like building an airplane on a computer.
Well, it's a necessary first step. And I personally would consider it all part of a continuum of learning to modify biological systems. But it is true that it's a very different approach. So the way I've thought about this before, it's kind of like the way engineering in biology has worked before is it's kind of like taking random parts from random cars and throwing them together in the hopes that you get a better car. Now, of course, it is more sophisticated than that. And when you make a change to a biological system, you always have to test it in some way to make sure that it works. And there's a great deal of art in that testing, the selection process. But it is true now that once you get up to 3, 4, 5 components, you really have to start thinking carefully and analyzing mathematically how all those pieces fit together and how they work. And again, 2, 3, 4 pieces. You could do that on a piece of paper with a pencil. You could sort that out probably. 20, 30, 100. Now here is clearly where we get to the point where we have to start using computers and relying on predictive models and simulations, and all those things have to work. They all have to be tested independently in order for any kind of predictive design to work in biology, and we're definitely not there yet.
Is there a particular example of some product of synthetic biology that maybe we could talk about that kind of represents where synthetic biology is right now? You know, something that someone's come up with that you think really does a good job of illustrating what scientists have figured out so far about this engineering problem?
Well, the kind of archetypal product in synthetic biology at the moment is artemisinin, a malaria drug. The thing that biology actually makes in this case is artemisinic acid. This is a project that was started by Jay Kieseling.
So I should explain, as my cat tries to walk on my computer, that could be a treatment for malaria. There's this drug that is derived from a plant, and it's called artemisinin, and it's very effective against malaria. And so Jay Kieseling, who you mentioned, he and others are using, I guess, E. coli and yeast. They're trying to figure out which will do the best job of assembling these molecules, sitting in a big vat rather than people having to go out and harvest these plants, and it's much slower and much more expensive. So, I actually saw just recently Kiesling's group published a paper showing that they had really cranked up the amount of of these molecules that can get out of these microbes. It's pretty impressive.
And it's also very impressive in that it's probably the most complex pathway that's been assembled so far. So the pathway that's working in yeast, the last time I checked in to the story, at any rate, was about 12 genes from 4 different organisms. So they have, largely by just being smart at what they do, really, managed to construct these pathways, testing at every step. They're really doing hardcore metabolic engineering. And one of the difficulties there is that even if you have a mathematical model of the system, it almost certainly isn't complete, which means that its predictive power is limited if you try to do something totally new with it, such as changing the metabolism of yeast, particularly if you are tweaking some part of the organism that the organism needs to survive, not just to make this chemical. So when Kiesling talks about this story, he typically refers to certain miracles that happen in the lab now and again, when things worked all of a sudden that hadn't been working or whatnot, and that kind of characterizes for me very much the way engineering these complex systems is proceeding at the moment. There isn't any overarching metabolic mathematical model that can be used, or genetic system model that can be used to describe how all these things work. So we're a very long way from the 777. We're really more like the Wright brothers, just barely getting off the ground.
Yeah, a while back on Blogging Heads, I talked to Craig Venter, who has stated that he hopes to or plans to create an entire synthetic genome and actually put this whole genome in a cell, and that cell will live. You know, he hasn't done it yet, but he's made some important steps in that direction. But you know, as you say, like this Kiesling, the work that Kiesling is doing on this malaria drug is kind of a Wright brothers level accomplishment. I mean, we're just talking, like you say, about maybe a dozen genes. I think that Venter is talking about a couple hundred genes to synthesize in this genome he wants to create. But you know, there are all these articles that are all over the place about him and how he's, you know, just about made, you know, created life and played God and so on and so forth. So, so what do you think? I mean, do you think that he's, you know, moments away from doing it, or are we looking, is this going to turn out to be a much harder problem than people might think?
Well, it depends on which problem you think might be hard. So it's already been demonstrated by Venter and others that you can transplant genomes from one cell to another and boot up a different organism from the organism you started with. So you can switch bacteria from one kind to another by changing their genomes. The question that most people focus on is whether you can pull that trick off with an entirely synthetic genome. So if you took, instead of taking bacteria out of one bacterium and sticking it in another and changing the species of the second bacterium into the first just by transplanting its genome, if you could construct from scratch by synthesis a genome from raw chemicals and then transplant that into an organism, then what? So what? Well, really it depends on whether you think that synthetic DNA is that different from the DNA we find in organisms living just outside the window. And clearly it's not, because we can take small pieces of that DNA and change the behavior of bacteria and plants and animals already. So that part isn't so clear to me that it's going to change the world. On the other hand, what Venter has done recently is show that you can go very rapidly from all the little pieces of DNA that instruments turn out to big pieces of DNA that organisms use in their genomes, or that constitute organisms' genomes. Which means that all of a sudden, and I do mean all of a sudden, it's a really pretty rapid change as far as the technology goes. All of a sudden, it's possible to take these little pieces that you can order commercially and turn them into a organismal-sized chromosome pretty rapidly. It's not clear what the size limits are. There are probably some design constraints. But nonetheless, it's demonstrated to work. Inventor mm-hmm. isn't the only one who's done that. There are other groups who have shown similar assembly. There are other people who have shown similar assembly tricks to work in yeast, and then mm-hmm. they can assemble whole working metabolic pathways that way from synthetic mm-hmm. DNA or from DNA that's harvested from other organisms. So now then back to the question of utility. Kiesling and Amyris Biotechnologies and all of his postdocs and grad students, everyone that works with him, they have 12 genes working. And those 12 mm-hmm. genes make artemisinic acid and variants of a class of chemicals that can be used for biofuels and flavorings and scents, and they're very widely useful. How soon are we going to be able to make use of the ability to assemble 100 genes at a time, 200 genes at a time? Mm-hmm. Not so clear to me that that's right around the corner, actually. Mm-hmm. I think that it's going to be a little while before we have the knowledge, the modeling capability to justify, economically anyway, in companies, playing with that many genes. On the other hand, mm-hmm. maybe as an academic project, something interesting will come out of that sooner, just people playing around. But mm-hmm. if you're trying to make something work in the economy, then it looks like 12 genes, given all the person years that went into making the artemisinic acid project work for treating malaria and then for biofuels, it looks like it's probably going to be 12, 15 genes for the near term.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So, Craig, it's interesting because Craig Venter's, one of his stated goals is that he wants to synthesize bugs that could generate a lot of energy for us, sort of biofuels type approach that Kiesling and others are going for. But you don't think that it... I guess you're saying that it may not be financially practical to go that route if you can just do the same thing with a dozen new genes, like people like Kiesling are doing?
Well, I'm saying first that a dozen genes was hard mm-hmm. enough. And they made great progress. They published lots mm-hmm. of nice papers describing how they did it. It isn't clear, though, that if you set out to rebuild that pathway in another organism, or mm-hmm. rebuild that pathway to do something else, that so much of the knowledge that they gained the first time around would be immediately applicable. So mm-hmm. All I'm saying is that anyone else who wants to make something as complex as the pathway that results in artemisinic acid is probably going to have to invest that same effort over again.
I see, yeah.
And then if you imagine that that's pretty useful, pretty interesting, actually. I mean, we're talking about influencing the lives of millions of people around the world through the drug mm-hmm. and potentially making substantial amounts of biofuel at very low cost from sugar, then do you need that 100 genes? And maybe the answer is yes, but I don't think anyone's demonstrated that you have to work at such a complex level yet, which means mm-hmm. that I just don't know, I can't think of a reason, there might be one, I can't think of a reason why we would need to synthesize genomes the size of hundreds of genes or bigger in the immediate future.
Mm-hmm. So synthetic biology has been attracting a lot of venture capital recently. It seems like it's one of these bright spots, at least as far as venture capitalists go. Do you think that investment's gonna pay off soon, or do you think this is just sort of a trend where people find some neat new thing and it's not really ready for prime time? I mean, I would assume that, you know, if they have to wait 30 or 40 years to get, you know, biofuels that are really going to do a great job economically, these venture capitalists won't be very happy.
Well, that's certainly true, right? They're interested in a few years, 10 years at the outside for their return on capital. But I think the good news is that there are clear examples where it's going to go faster. So mm-hmm. is that going to solve our problem? Well, it depends on what you think our problem is. Is our problem relying on foreign oil? Is it relying? Is it reducing our carbon emissions? Hard to say at this point where all the volume would come from biofuels to reduce or eliminate all of the petroleum that we use at the moment. There are arguments about how we could do it if we planted lots of feedstocks, across all of North America and in Brazil, places with lots of good agricultural land. Of course, there are arguments about food and water that result from the competitive use of that land. Then there are other fuels that might result from planting crops that aren't suitable for food and grow on land that presently isn't used for growing food. This is an argument, or discussion anyway, that will play out over the next decade, and we'll just have to see how it goes. I think the numbers at the moment suggest we'll be okay. Companies like Amyris and LS9 are building bugs. They have bugs in the lab that turn various feedstocks, could be sugar, could be grass, into fuel. The market, in some sense, the price we pay at the pump will determine whether or not these things actually serve us well in the very near term. But I don't think it's going to take decades for biofuels that result from synthetic biology to have some kind of influence. It's just the size of the influence that I'm uncertain about.
I've done some research on sort of what people have found in terms of what the environmental impact might be if synthetic biology takes off for fuels, and I'm just sort of surprised at how little there is. There was a lot of work that was put into figuring out the effects of ethanol once. There are all these subsidies that were put in place to encourage ethanol from corn, and it's pretty clear now that ethanol from corn is not great for the environment if you just look at it, sort of the full picture, in terms of like how much carbon is released into the atmosphere in just the whole process of raising corn and producing ethanol from it. But no one seems to have really thought about synthetic biology, and I was really surprised, like, talking to some environmentalists where they'd say, gee, I don't really know. I mean, tell me again what this is. And so I would explain how, well, maybe these engineered E. coli could take sugar from, sugar plantations in Brazil or some other kinds of plants planted here and convert them directly into fuels, not just ethanol, but maybe diesel and so on. And they'd say, oh, wow. So it just seems like synthetic biology is just really not on people's radar yet.
Well, it's also probably a bit early to be loudly advertising the promise of synthetic biology to solve all the world's problems. I don't think that we have to start from scratch with a lot of the environmental or economic analyses when it comes to thinking about how synthetic biology and the fuels that result from synthetic biology might be different than corn-based ethanol or cellulosic ethanol. They all rely on all these fuels rely on large volumes of feedstock that are grown somewhere. Could be corn, could be switchgrass, could be miscanthus, another rapid-growing grass, could be sugarcane. In all cases, the feedstocks have certain costs. We have to decide whether we're going to engineer the feedstocks or whether we're going to use non-GM feedstocks. This question is going to, again, play out over the next decade or so. Science in general, plant engineers, are beginning to really get a handle on how to modify plants in new ways, very rapidly and in a more targeted fashion that's happened in the past. Mm-hmm. So the different kinds of feedstocks, modified with different traits, will be available relatively soon. Do we go ahead and just throw all those genes and all those modified organisms out into the environment and hope that that's okay? We have to answer that question. Then we have to sort out how we might gather up all those crops and turn them into fuels. It's not a small problem. The amount of infrastructure required to harvest all of that material, let's just say it's cellulosic ethanol or turning corn stover, the stalks, the leftover material from corn, into ethanol. We don't even have that problem solved. So we're talking about potentially huge infrastructure investments in rail and processing plants, barges, whatnot, to move the materials and the fuels around. That's just in the U.S., right? If other people, if other countries want to similarly use large volumes of biofuels, then they will have to solve similar problems too. Maybe we'll say, okay, we're just going to use non-GM grasses, non-GM feedstocks, could be even poplar trees, that grow rapidly but nonetheless aren't GM. In which case, okay, we're not so worried then about genes moving around in the environment, but we still have this problem of moving feedstocks around to wherever the processing plant is, which then presumably would have genetically modified organisms in tanks. It looked more like brewing beer at a very large scale. And then we'd have to move the fuel around once it was processed. So there's one vision of the future. Although I wonder, and this is just a question, it's a hypothesis. I don't know that this is going to come true, but I also can't see that it won't come true. We brew beer at many different scales. If you look at histograms of the size of beer breweries over time, in the U.S. anyway, for much of the last few decades, beer brewing was dominated by a small number of very large breweries. And now the histogram looks very different. We have a very large number of very small breweries distributed around the country. And if fuel starts to look more like brewing beer, so if you have an organism that turns a feedstock into fuel, and the basically just requires a tank, and then you pump the fuel out of the tank and possibly have to run it through a filter, but then you put it in your car, does that have to look like the existing petroleum industry, or could it look like microbrewing? I think that's an interesting question that we'll slowly begin to see answers to over the next 5 to 10 years.
I found it really interesting how how you're trying to think ahead to where this all might be going, and I mean, obviously trying to predict any sort of future is really difficult, and when you've got something like synthetic biology where there are all these factors we've just been talking about, which, you know, are so unconstrained, it can be a bit overwhelming. But you managed to sort of crystallize some of your ideas into these four possible futures, and I like these names you give you about the future of research into biology. You've got the Gilded Lab, Modular Life, Barricades, and the Underworld. And so maybe we could sort of talk about these one at a time and what each of these futures would be like, and, you know, how we'd get there, and, you know, what would it be like? So, you know, what is the Gilded Lab? G-U-I-L-D-E-D.
Well, let's start off and just talk briefly about what resulted in those four stories. So those are four scenarios that were derived from work I did with Bioeconomic Research Associates. My colleagues Jim Newcomb and Steve Aldrich there have a great deal of experience telling scenarios, building scenarios, stories about the future, different possibilities, based on their work in the energy industry. And now they've moved that kind of work into thinking about more about biology. So we were all funded to work on a project for the Department of Energy here in the U.S., thinking about what happens when we have the ability to synthesize and design new genomes. What does that mean for our economy? What does it mean for our security? We didn't really touch ethics in that report simply because it wasn't in the remit from the DOE, but that clearly is important too. What happens, what does it really mean for us on a larger scale when we can start building organisms willy-nilly? That's an important question that this particular report doesn't deal with. But in any event, in order to constrain the questions a little bit, we picked two different variables, two axes of a plot, to try to serve as the basis for telling the story. One axis was, is the technology hard or easy to develop? Does it go fast or slow? Is it hard to build organisms with 12 new genes, or is it easy? Or is it hard to do more than two or three? And then the other axis is, how does the government respond to this? Is policy encouraging of all of this, or are restrictions put on access to the technology that make it harder to have access to tools and skills? So these four stories then occupy the four different quadrants that result from crossing these two different variables. And I don't have that picture in front of me, so you'll have to remind me which quadrant the Gilded Lab is in if we're going to start there.
Let's see. Let's see, let me grab my paper here. So the Gilded Lab was kind of in this GILDED. Gilded Lab. It's over, it's on the axis where end where it says that genome engineering is difficult and expensive, and government policy is supportive. Public and private funding supports laboratory research programs. Biological engineering meets challenging technical obstacles. Economic implications are small. Investors are disappointed.
Well, now you've read the whole scenario, so what do I have to
do? Oh, there we go. We can move on. So basically, basically, this would be what would happen. This would just be a case where the hype would be, things would not quite live up to the hype, and it would just be some interesting research that would be very expensive and done in a few labs. And that's one possibility.
That's right. So there could well be important economic results, but it just turns out to be hard. The government is quite supportive, spends a lot of money trying to push biology to produce new useful things, but despite all best efforts of people in the lab, doesn't work out so well. So the Gilded Lab has lots of money, but going slow.
Okay. All right. So then, over on the corner where the government policy is supportive and biology... The genome engineering is cheap, that's where you have this thing called modular life. And I guess, would this be where you've used the phrase garage biology? Is this where garage biology would pop up?
That is correct. And, just to cut to the chase, that seems to be where we're headed, actually. So modular life in particular refers to the ability to combine pieces that have discrete functions as modules to create new functions, create new value, if you're talking about an economic effort, if you're talking about a company. And there's really nothing on the market today with revenues that results from this idea of modular life, from just combining pieces in this way. But I don't think it's that far away. So if you look at how that kind of engineering or assembly or just hacking is done now, there's a library of parts that's maintained by MIT and supported by something called the BioBricks Foundation. And those BioBricks parts, if I've got the trademarked name correctly, I'm sure I'll hear from Drew, Andy, if I don't, those BioBricks parts, BioBrick parts? Anyway, are in a freezer somewhere. Those are DNA. They're also stored electronically in a data sheet. And the idea is, just as you pull transistors and resistors and capacitors and counters and amplifiers off the shelf, they're described by particular specifications, so too can you pull biological parts off the shelf, pull them out of the registry, and assemble them into objects that have, or circuits, organisms, that have predictable behaviors. Every year there's a competition at MIT, or the jamborees at MIT. It's called the International Genetically Engineered Machines Competition, iGEM. And it's undergraduates and some graduate students from all over the world, and they design and build a new circuit based on either existing BioBricks or new BioBricks that they bring into the registry. And the progress that those teams have made in the past 5 years is quite astonishing. So just this last year, there was a team from Slovenia that built and tested three synthetic vaccines against H. pylori. It's the bacterium that causes many ulcers. They built and tested those three synthetic vaccines for their undergraduate summer research project. There are no existing vaccines for H. pylori anywhere in the world. Right? So that's truly groundbreaking work. It's true that they tested them in mice, and as the saying goes, you can get anything to work in a mouse. It's very different than getting it to work in a human. But nonetheless, these were undergraduates.
Yeah, this is right. Undergraduates in Slovenia doing a summer project. I mean, that's quite something. Yeah, I went up to this competition, I guess, 3 or 4 years ago now, and it was pretty amazing then. And just keeping up with how they've been doing ever since, it just seems like the projects get more and more impressive. And somehow it seems the students get younger and younger. I don't understand that. But they're making progress. So do you think that it's do you think part of it is the fact that they've got this pool of standard parts to work with now?
I think that they have the idea. So one of the things that's quite crucial to know about the existing pool of parts is that not all of them work. And of the few that work, most of them don't work as advertised. They're not all fully characterized in the same way as a transistor or a resistor that you buy commercially is. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty big hurdle to overcome. On the other hand, it took decades for the electronics and semiconductor industry to assemble that list of parts and have them available for people to use. So there's no reason to expect that we're going to get there overnight with biological parts, especially when we're relying primarily on volunteer undergraduates to produce those parts.
Yeah.
That said, because there's a model to work on, and what I mean by that is there's the model of electronics, there's the model of aviation, it's clear how modular parts have aided design and manufacturing in those areas. There's no reason to think it won't work that way in biology, even if it's hard. And watching what the undergraduates do every year, it's clear they've got that bug now. They understand what they're trying to get at. And they're producing those new parts. They're figuring out new ways to connect them together. They're even producing new mathematical models, really cutting-edge stuff, to help understand how this complex system works. And all of that stuff is in the public domain. It's all available to anybody who wants to use it, which means that that innovation based on those tools, based on those parts, is not restricted to universities. It is, in fact, getting out into the garage. So my startup company started in my garage several years ago. It's not totally unheard of for a biotechnology company to start in a garage. I'm not claiming I had the first one of those. But for me, this was a test to see if I, given my skill set, right, I've never actually taken a laboratory class in biology. Everything I know is self-taught, pretty much. I'm a physicist by training. What could I, if I started out into my garage, accomplish using this idea of DNA synthesis and mail order? And we got pretty far, actually. The widget that we're trying to make and sell is not the most complex thing ever devised, but it does work. And so the DNA that I received yesterday in the mail is for a redesigned component of that widget, and I'll be testing that today and over the next few days, and hopefully we'll actually be able to start selling versions of this new widget here within the next couple of months. And that didn't require any massive government funding. It didn't require any massive corporate funding. That was just something that my partner and I funded out of our pockets, out of our consulting fees, as we run the rest of the company. And there's no reason to think that I'm the only one who's working this way, right? There should be lots of garage companies that show up. And in fact, there's now this amateur organization called DIY Bio, Do-It-Yourself Bio, which is dedicated to enabling people, helping people figure out how to be innovators, or even just to play with these same sets of tools and models that I have access to, that the undergraduates have access to. Innovation in the garage, in biology, is here.
So you've got these two other kind of darker alternatives, and so one is called Barricades and one is called Underworld. So in Barricades, the government is, the government's not supportive about genome engineering, and it's difficult to do. So as you say here, that the government funding just focuses on biodefense, and there are a lot of restrictions that are put on. And then the Underworld, I see here, is sort of where you have this total restriction on synthetic biology. But if it's really cheap to do, like you were just describing, then people just go underground and start doing it, and then you have lots of unregulated activity outside the U.S. What would you see happening to kind of turn what right now seems kind of like the modular life version of this, the garage biology? What would push it in one of these other directions, you know, where the government might clamp down and highly regulate it, or it sort of becomes like alcohol in the Prohibition era?
Well, if you're asking about an event that could cause the government to change its course, it could be just bad publicity. There is lots of discussion in the press about the negative consequences of access to this technology. So if teenagers can hack viruses, what do we do? Is that good? Is that bad? Most of the time, the press reports come down on, well, it's very bad. We can't allow that. Given that the costs are falling and skills are proliferating, most AP biology students probably have more formal in high school, that is, probably have more formal training than I do in genetically modifying bacteria. It's not clear to me how we stop that, especially if we hope to rely on that skill base in our economy to make vaccines or fuels or whatnot. So it could just be that we decide as a society, or that our politicians decide that we shouldn't allow that somehow. And that conversation crops up sometimes. Or it could be that there's some kind of accident or intentional release of an organism that was produced using synthetic biology that suggests to people that we ought to go a different path. But then once again, I would say, well, the access to the technology is already distributed. Access to the reagents is already very distributed. Costs have fallen. If you wanted to build a DNA synthesizer from scratch in your garage, it might be challenging, but you could do it. It wouldn't be that hard. Plans for a DNA synthesizer have been published on the web for many years now, more than a decade. It's not the, you know, it's not the the most fancy hybrid electric vehicle version of a DNA synthesizer. It's not a Ferrari, even. Nonetheless, it works. And you can build that out of parts that are available quite commonly. And even if those parts weren't available commonly, the manufacturing infrastructure is now pretty widespread to order out those parts. So I don't see how you could prevent access to the kind of background instrumentation that's necessary to make any of this work either. Again, it might be expensive, might be difficult, but you could do it if you wanted to. I would say it's probably more expensive and more difficult to hack cars and airplanes in the way that many amateurs do, or to maintain a boat, for that matter, which I can assure you is quite expensive. So there could be some event that in effect causes the public to call for restriction of access. But then how would that actually play out? We can gather some examples of some historical examples of previous efforts of prohibition. So the first one you mentioned is, in fact, what we call prohibition here in this country, restricting the production and sale of alcohol. Crime rose dramatically, organized crime in particular, to take advantage of the fact that the production and sale of alcohol was prohibited, but nonetheless was quite easy to effect in your garage or in your, you know, warehouse that was relatively nondescript. A similar thing happened as a result fairly recently of the U.S. government's efforts to restrict methamphetamine production in this country. So the DEA, in about 2002 or so, decided to really crack down on domestic methamphetamine production. Before that, a substantial fraction of meth was made in mom-and-pop operations, making very small volumes. And after that, production moved to centralized, very professional operations. And the DEA's own characterization of this is that they know less about meth production and distribution than they did before. So the black market that emerged from restriction is even blacker and harder to see into than it was beforehand. And the latest that I checked, meth use in this country was still rising, which means that meth is still getting in from outside, or it's still being made more professionally inside this country. In any event, use is going up despite all these restrictions. So I'm not trying to make a political comment about drug policy. I'm merely observing that here's an example of a widely distributed technology, namely chemistry, that's used to make meth. The government tried to restrict the use of certain reagents to make meth, and they've tried to crack down on the production process itself, and that's resulted in a broader market composed of professionals who are better at implementing that criminal activity, engaging in that criminal activity, than the amateurs were before. And we have more meth on the streets. So I'm not saying that that would absolutely happen with biology, but again, it's kind of like with the distributed biofuels, the brewing of biofuels question. I don't see why it shouldn't happen. Why? Explain to me you know, why that wouldn't happen again. There are already various kinds of genetically modified systems that are traded on the black market. EPO is used as a epigen, which amplifies the production of red blood cells in your body. It's used as a performance-enhancing drug by athletes. There's a worldwide trade in genetically modified seeds for plants.
So epigen is how is that produced?
Epigen is made in human cell culture, I believe. So the production of it is probably relatively expensive and constrained, rather, at this point in time, simply because it has to be high quality. It is actually a drug that has to be made to within certain quality standards. So the off-label use that we're seeing is probably based on production that is in fact tracked by the government in some way. But nonetheless, people are using it off-label. They're using it for purposes that it's not intended for, and that are in fact illegal.
I see. I'm sorry. So, and then you were talking about genetically modified seeds.
Right. So there's for many years been a black market trade in genetically modified seeds around the world, and that has some value. My point in all of this is just to say that there's already this black market trade in the fruits of early biological engineering, and I don't see that we can necessarily turn that off somehow in the future. It hasn't worked in any other, well, I don't know any other, but it didn't work with methamphetamine production. It didn't work in prohibition. So it's unclear to me how we would restrict access to biological technologies in the future should we choose to do so.
Well, one thing that wasn't all that clear to me in the scenarios you were working on was how it fits into that, those scenarios is a criticism that I've seen a lot from environmental groups or groups that are concerned about poverty in the developing world, where they argue that synthetic biology is basically a new tool that large corporations can use to take over even more resources, so that people have to plant genetically modified crops, or land is given over to raising food for energy, through some giant, corporation that's like a hybrid between Monsanto and Exxon or something like that. So some people have been very critical of synthetic biology on those grounds, and certainly, there are some big corporations that are getting really interested in it. I'm curious what you think about that side of things, particularly given the contrast between the way big corporations go about doing things and someone like you in your garage. Is garage biology and sort of open access biology going to be able to survive in a world that for the most part is dominated by corporations with patents and large amounts of control over resources?
Well, I suppose the first thing to observe is that if you go look, again, in other parts of the economy, try to find some inspiration for the future of biology in the way other parts of human activity work now, there's a distribution of large and small companies in software and hardware. There are increasing numbers of small companies in aviation, even. We're back to aviation started in the garage, proceeded through a course where it was extremely expensive to develop a new aircraft, and all of a sudden, we're back to garage biology, right? The spacecraft that won the XPRIZE challenge was basically developed in a garage. Not everyone has $25 million to put into their garage spacecraft, but nonetheless, $25 million is considerably less than Boeing is spending on its latest aircraft. My point being just that there's a distribution, and that distribution changes over time. Hang on, I just got another call that's interfering here. My apologies. So,
that's okay.
That distribution changes over time, and there's no reason to expect biology really to look that different than other pieces of the economy. And I think people tend to get very fixated on the pluses and minuses of how things look right now without paying that much attention to the larger scope. We're not at the end of biology. We're not at the beginning of biological engineering. We're somewhere in between. I portrayed efforts at building biological systems now as like the Wrights, but the Wrights weren't the beginning either, right? People have been trying to build heavier-than-air aircraft for decades.
That's true.
Really as a concerted effort before that. And for centuries, there were stories about how to do it, people trying and dying because they didn't have the right story, they didn't have the right design. So we'll see that distribution change over time here in the U.S. as well and around around the world. For most of the history of biotechnology, it's been big companies that could afford to play. It took a lot of man-hours, a lot of reagents, in order to modify biological system. There's a reason Genentech was founded with venture money. And there's a reason they went after the drug market to start with, because that's where the money is. And if you start with big money as an investment, you have to go after big money to get the payoff. But my company in particular was founded, in contrast, to go after small markets to start with. So we didn't need that much money to start with. We could pay for it ourselves. And the reduction in cost, the fact that I can outsource DNA synthesis, all of that contributes to a very different infrastructure for companies of all sizes now than existed when Genentech started. And as far as control goes, it's true, patents are a problem. But I would point out that a distinct thread throughout all of my work, all of Drew Endy's work, all of Jay Kiesling's work, anyone who has really been thinking hard about this problem, Richard Jefferson at Cambia in Australia, is that, and many others, of course, is that we have to be careful about this issue of control. Patents are already causing bottlenecks in research. But all of the parts in the BioBricks registry are open source. They're all in the public domain. So there's not an answer to this question, and I don't have an answer. In fact, all I have is questions at this point in time. But it's pretty clear that the problem is being addressed or being thought about on many different fronts. I don't expect that it's going to look any cleaner than Microsoft versus Linux. It could be that messy in biology as well. That would be a shame, because we're relying on biology for new vaccines, for other disease treatments, stem cells, etc. We're relying on biology for increased yields of various food crops. We're relying on biology for fuels, potentially. So if progress in all those things is slowed down by IP concerns, it's very different than if the latest operating system for your PC is slower because of an IP concern, right? People die versus some company doesn't make quite as much money 1 year. Again, I don't have all the answers, but people are asking the question. So it's perfectly reasonable for critics to stand up and say, well, I'm really concerned about, you know, Biosoft or a biological version of Intel, or I'm really concerned that Monsanto is going to own all of the IP around genetically modifying any plant. That's reasonable to ask that question. You also have to pay attention to what's happening in the real world. Does Monsanto own all IP around modifying plants? Well, in fact, no. There are other companies that own important technologies. There are open source versions of genetic modification techniques for plants. There's an ecosystem of companies. There's an ecosystem of ideas about how to go forward. And it will be an interesting next 10 years, to be sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I'm definitely looking forward to seeing your book when it comes out.
Me too. It's been a long time coming.
it's really intriguing. So. But I see we've talked for about an hour, so I guess we should wrap it up. So,
all right.
So thanks a lot, and I think I'm pretty sure that a lot of people are going to find this talk pretty interesting.
And I'm happy to chat again.
Bucking heads.
Thank you very much, Carl. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Take care.